Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 422. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line. Send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com. Stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay. Like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a wonderful episode for you this week. Let me introduce our guest. Brian Silva is the founder and executive director of the National Equality Action Team, an organization that has as its mission to harness the unique power of LGBTQ people, their allies, and community partners to educate and take collective action across issues in the fight for capital J justice, which we will talk about. Brian has been a leader in the LGBTQ advocacy community for more than a decade, which has included serving as the executive director of Marriage Equality USA, one of the nation's oldest and largest volunteer grassroots LGBTQ groups. But right this very second, he's hanging out with us. Brian, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me. It's nice to be here.
We got a lot of ground to cover, Brian. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
You know, sometimes in the LGBTQ community, we use phrases like emergency planning and disaster contingency procedures to talk about our work, but you actually started in that type of work.
I did. I moved to New York to go to school for emergency and disaster management. So helping folks to plan and prepare and recover from man-made and natural disasters. So crisis is in my blood.
In 10 years of doing this show, we have never had someone who has that type of background. What was little Brian running around on the playground saying? An earthquake's coming? Like, what drove you to that work?
You know, I've always been drawn to work where you're able to give back and help others. I started out as a teacher, and when I discovered the field of emergency management, it just kind of encompassed all of my passions and the things that make me want to get up in the morning and go and do work. So, you know, crisis and disaster, folks are extraordinarily vulnerable. But more importantly, it's an area where we actually have the ability to do a lot of preparation for it and to prevent, you know, loss of life and loss of property. But that's a very political thing that has to get done. Most people don't want to make changes until they're confronted with having to do that. And so, you know, there was a lot of pieces of the puzzle, and it made every day, you know, interesting.
Amazing. At some point, there was a transition from emergency planning and response to marriage equality. That had to have been a pretty intentional move.
Well, you know, it's strange. I actually kind of fell into it. I was living in New York. I'm from California originally. And when the Prop 8 campaign to repeal marriage equality in California was going on in 2008, there wasn't a lot that I could do living in New York. But what I could do was phone bank from home. And that's what I signed up to volunteer to do. Of course, the election happened, and all of us were devastated. And so I went to the protest that they had in New York, as they had all across the country, and met folks from Marriage Equality New York, which was the local chapter at the time. And made that, you know, dumb decision that we all do. I put my name on a piece of paper saying, sure, I'll volunteer to do something. And, you know, 10 years later, here I am. And that's one of the beauties of that I really loved about Marriage Equality USA, is it was volunteer driven. And literally somebody could start with an idea, with wanting to do something, and work their way up to, you know, kind of helming the organization.
I would imagine that the family Silva had some things to say when you announced you would be moving over to the marriage equality realm.
Well, you know, it was there was a lot of discussion about it. My partner Jonathan and I, you know, we those kinds of decisions we try to make together. But I've always been an advocate. I've always been, you know, volunteering and been involved with things. So I think there was probably a little bit of relief that all the extra volunteer work was now going to be able to do full time. Didn't mean there was going to be any less amount of time working on it, but yeah, I've had a very supportive group of friends and family on this journey.
Love it. Love it. We had Evan Wolfson on the show. He was on the show maybe a few months back, and we were talking about that big transition point of when the Supreme Court says, okay, we're good here. We're going to do some marriage equality here in the U.S. How did that transition your focus for your nonprofit work?
So fortunately, we started a conversation quite a ways before that happened.
Yeah.
And so that we weren't, you know, kind of taken off guard. And, you know, we had a lot of discussion. You know, do we shut down? Do we continue? Do we work internationally? And we talked with our board. We talked with our members. And what we decided was that, you know, our organization was founded on a very specific mission to pass marriage equality in the United States. And there's so many great organizations out there doing other great work that we should find a way to close down and support them and make sure that our 20 years of existence was kind of put out into the movement in multiple ways. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why NEAT was spun off and eventually became what it is today was, you know, we can't have full equality without marriage, but marriage is far from full equality. And so it was really important that everything that we had gained and put together and built in 20 years didn't just, you know, get put in a museum to not be used to help other communities, other issues that our community faces.
Yeah, before we do that dive into NEAT, you know, one of the things that you all trumpet on your website is just how it's built on 20 years of grassroots efforts. What are the lessons that we need to carry forward from what we've learned to do this work right now?
Well, I think one of the things is that, you know, we need national leaders and we need national organizations. But at the end of the day, a lot of change happens on a very personal, grassroots, you know, volunteer, one-on-one driven area. And so making sure that we are listening to local communities, that we're listening to grassroots activists, listening to the people who are actually affected by these laws and by the things that are going on, and make sure that we're creating space for them to take leadership roles and to really drive the work.
Nice. Well, let's get into NEAT. I read earlier that, you know, the goal of NEAT to harness this community, to harness our unique power. For people who are wondering, okay, but what do they actually do? What do you guys actually do?
So we have a couple of different programs, but they're all built around harnessing individual people, grassroots leaders, community-based, and bringing folks together to take collective action. So one of our signature programs is our Phone for the Home program. So we'll be involved with different campaigns. For example, right now we're doing a public education campaign in Massachusetts, talking to people about who transgender people are, what these non-discrimination laws are that we're passing, why they're important, and helping to dispel myths and build support for transgender equality and justice overall. So, you know, one person making calls, maybe not that effective. You know, 20 people making calls every night, five nights a week, brings that collective action to bear on something that has, you know, oftentimes been hard to get people to take action around. And because it's also built on this, you know, everything trying to be as remote as possible, anybody can sign up from anywhere to, you know, to get involved. Anybody can call and talk to somebody about why, you know, transgender issues are important, and make sure that we're reaching out and doing that. So that's really the core of what we try to do at NEAT, is to really, you know, harness and just explode the community energy. So often in the places where we have better laws, we have lots of people that want to take action. And in places where we need to make a lot of change, our resources are very thin. NEAT gives people the opportunity to virtually show up in those communities and stand side by side with people, you know, in red states and rural states and suburban areas, you know, and help them to fight for their own justice.
I love it. We're folks to go over to theneat.org, which I recommend that they do. What if people are thinking, well, gosh, look at all these typos on the website, Brian. They keep capitalizing the word justice. Why are they doing that?
I know. It's people often ask us about that. And we follow this idea of Big J justice. It goes back to our belief that LGBTQ people and our allies, there's a unique energy that our community possesses. Nobody in the LGBTQ community is a single issue person because none of them lead single issue lives, as Audre Lorde said. You know, we are people of color. We are people affected by a broken criminal justice system. We are people who access reproductive health services. We are people who are immigrants and affected by a broken immigration system. And then we also happen to be LGBTQ or allies of people who are. So when we talk about Big J justice, we mean, you know, the whole thing from kind of bookend to bookend. That, you know, we can't just pass non-discrimination or marriage. We can't just focus on things that only affect LGBTQ people. We also have to focus on the things that also affect us, like healthcare reform, along with banning conversion therapy. And so our movement around Big J Justice is looking at our community holistically and making sure that we're pushing forward on all fronts, so that, you know, a student who is protected by an anti-bullying law that we pass, you know, also has access to, you know, reproductive health services at Planned Parenthood, who also has a family who is making a living wage, who, you know, if the family are immigrants, undocumented, that we're fighting to make sure that they and their family have a safe and, you know, secure place to call home. And that's what it means, you know, to look outside of who we are beyond just our sexual orientation and gender identity.
I love that. You know, so much of this work is trying to find that powerful intersection between race and sexual orientation. Talk to our listeners a little bit about how you all are approaching that, because I know there is so much racial justice work in how you're approaching the power of our community.
Yeah. So the very first thing that we're doing is we're listening. NEAT was not founded as a racial justice organization. You know, we have stood in solidarity and supported other organizations. And so this being our first year in existence as a standalone organization, we're starting slowly and we're moving slowly, and we're talking to folks that we've partnered with in the past and asking the question of, you know, how can we show up? How can we show up and be there and be effective? We have these programs that we can, you know, utilize. We have canvassing programs. We have phone from home programs. We have access to a network of grassroots organizers all around the country who have shown up for different LGBTQ work. And we want to be able to bring all of those to bear, you know, on issues like racial justice. We don't want to overextend so that, you know, we do everything, you know, kind of halfway. We want to pick a few things. We're small right now, and as we grow, then we can add those on and make sure we're doing it most effectively. But that's really how we're going to do it, is we're going to ask the folks that are working in the space, we're going to offer what it is that we have, and then we'll move forward from there.
Another piece of this puzzle that we love covering is the intergenerational piece of this work, especially for an organization like yours that has evolved and has been doing this work for so long and seen the changes. How do you approach harnessing the power? How do you approach making progress in a way that connects different generations together?
Well, the beauty of NEAT, and especially our Phone from Home program and our regional canvassing program, is, you know, when everybody gets on the phone, we have, you know, grandmothers and grandchildren. We've got parents and we've got, you know, young adults. And so everybody is coming together from their couch, from, you know, from Maine all the way to Montana, Missouri, you know, everywhere. And everybody's sitting in the same virtual room and working together. When we are doing the phone banking, we have an online chat system to support people, and everybody is, you know, kind of crowdsourcing answers as people propose questions. So it's really a place where we can bring people together of all different backgrounds, but especially, you know, intergenerational, and folks get a chance to get to know each other and start to work together in ways that, you know, maybe they haven't been exposed to, or maybe, you know, haven't had the opportunity to.
Nice. What does the executive director of the National Equality Action Team do?
Well, he happens to be about a jack of all trades.
Nice.
A little bit right now. So because we are built on a volunteer system, and we really feel like that is a huge strength, as of right now, I'm the only, you know, staff member that we have. So, you know, we're doing everything from building new partnerships of organizations that want to join and support NEAT with getting their volunteers involved, running the phone banks, doing the fundraising, you know, building new alliances. It's kind of a little bit of everything, which, you know, makes it very fun and interesting every day, you know, when I get to go into work.
I get worried that you're lonely, but you're not lonely over there.
No, I work with some of the very best people in the whole world. If folks go to our neat.org/hero website, we have a program of we call them our heroes, because we think that heroes are really the everyday people that show up. And these are our folks that every week call in at least once a week. We have one volunteer who calls three and four times a week. And these folks are my staff, my friends. They're part of the NEAT family. That's how we approach our volunteer system. Is, you know, people are welcomed. They're a part of our team. They're a part of our family. Whether they volunteer once or they've been volunteering, like some of these folks have been, for 5 years.
Nice. At the end of the day, how do you? Because right, one of your roles is doing that assessment piece. How do you measure if you guys are being effective?
Well, a couple different ways. You know, on the issues that we're working on, obviously, you know, when we're looking to pass or change policy, at the end of the day, like in Jacksonville, Florida, we, you know, we're part of the team that helped to pass the citywide non-discrimination law. That's, you know, that's obviously pretty tangible that, you know, that we can get. And we also look at, you know, are we growing the compact of organizations that we partner with? For example, Equality New York and the National LGBTQ Task Force both just joined, meaning that they are recruiting their own volunteers to volunteer through NEAT on campaigns that they, you know, that they care about. So, you know, we look at those measures of success. And then we also look at our volunteers and our core team, the people that show up, you know, every week as part of NEAT. And as we're growing those, that obviously gives us the ability to get involved with more campaigns and make more calls or knock on more doors or take more actions. And all of those are fortunately, you know, are growing, which is great, especially with this. You know, we've been a program of different organizations for 5 years, but this is NEAT's first year operating on its own. So to see the positive response from people, to see the continued growth is obviously really, really exciting for us.
I would imagine that one of the challenges in doing this work the way you guys do it is that there are these regional differences. You know, you talk about this work in Florida, which I would imagine is markedly different than the work you all getting involved in Texas. How do you incorporate in how different regions approach LGBTQ issues differently into the way you approach making change?
So we have kind of a series of guiding principles on when we get involved, you know, one of them being the unique role that LGBTQ people have to play and need to play, the big J justice. But the other is that we do not get involved with any action or any campaign without a local partner on the ground. And they are the driving force. So we can bring the infrastructure, we can bring the troops, as it were, we can bring our expertise and know-how from being involved in 30 plus different, you know, campaigns. But we bring that to them and say, this is what we have to offer. This is what we can do. You tell us how we can be most useful. How do we want to write scripts so that it's reflective of your community? What type of wording do we want to use? When do we want to be calling? What do we want to be calling about? And all of those decisions are made by our local campaign partners. So it's a very bottom-up approach, because we do believe that folks on the ground generally have the best idea of how to move their community forward. And we're there to, you know, share what we know and what we've learned, and then to basically, you know, serve them and their community for whatever time period they need us. And so we, you know, can move on to the next action and help somebody else.
Yeah. I would imagine there are any number of ways our listeners could get involved.
Absolutely. So we would love, you know, if folks would like to volunteer, we currently have shifts available through mid-November. We usually taper it off in the end of the year with the holidays. They can go to the neat.org/volunteer to sign up. Also on our website, if you can't volunteer, you know, we would love to have folks make a financial contribution. We are able to squeeze a dollar out of a dime, which is great, but we still need a dime. And so any financial help that people can give is appreciated. And if somebody listening, you know, runs an organization or is just, you know, a community leader in you know, where they live, and they'd like to find out more about how their organization can partner, either getting their members involved, making phone calls, or maybe they have an action or, you know, a campaign that's going to be coming up, they can also reach out to us as well, and let's see how we can, you know, we can bring them on board, or we can support what it is they're doing.
All right. Well, and finally, let's get personal for a second. Brian, how does this work feed you?
Well, you know, I always tell folks when we're doing our trainings, especially when we're doing campaigns that can sometimes be more difficult, talking to people that might be generally opposed to, you know, what we're working on, or just nights where, you know, there's a lot of people that are not home, is there are millions of people all across the country who each day wake up and live in a safer, more just community because of the work that I do, but more importantly, that our volunteers do, people who we will never meet, faces that we will never see, thank yous that we will probably never hear. And so for me, knowing that massive effect, that far-reaching effect that NEAT is able to have on the communities that we support is the fire in my belly that that moves me to get out of bed each morning and to keep it going. And for the people all across the country who live in places that don't have LGBTQ organizations, which is actually most of the country, suburban, rural areas, especially redder areas, NEAT for many of them is their first opportunity to connect with an organization or other LGBTQ advocates. And they're doing it, you know, remotely. They're doing it from home. They're building a community. They're meeting new people. And they're finally able to, you know, to really take action and take action in their own hands to not only support other people's, you know, fight for justice in communities across the nation, but eventually, you know, their own and in their own. So those are the two things that every day, you know, whenever the work gets really hard, and it does get hard, especially in these trying times in our country, those are the types of things that help to keep me centered and grounded and moving forward.
Brian Silva is the founder and executive director of the National Equality Action Team, NEAT. You guys can stroll on over to theneat.org. That's theneat.org. And you can learn all about how they are harnessing the unique power of LGBTQ people, their allies, and community partners to educate and take collective action across issues in the fight for capital J justice. That is not a typo. Brian, you guys are doing pretty darn important work out there. I urge you to keep going, but I don't think you need my urging. There's so much more to do.
Well, thank you. And thanks for the opportunity to share our vision and our work with other folks. And I hope they find a way to get involved.
Hello, hello, baby. You called. I can't hear a thing. I have got no service in the club. You say. What did you say? Oh, you're breaking up on me. Sorry, I cannot hear you. I'm kind of busy.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we have tons of time left on this week's episode to get to all of the latest LGBTQ news. But first, can I say happy anniversary to us? It's actually our anniversary. It was 9 years ago. That would be 9 years ago that we debuted on WVEWLP Brattleboro Community Radio, where we still play. Shout out Brattleboro. I miss you guys there in Vermont. But yeah, 9 years ago we debuted in Vermont, and we are now entering our 10th year of This Show Is So Gay. I can't quite believe it. It was our goal at the start to do maybe like 10 or 15 episodes. And as you heard at the start of this week's show, this is episode number 422. How is that possible? You should, of course, visit thisshowisogay.com, because one of the fun things to do on there is to click on the guests tab. Thisshowisogay.com, click on guests, and you can see just the most ridiculous roster of people we have had. It's probably 500-600 people at this point over the past 9 years of doing this show. And it's not about you listening to every episode, though. My gosh, if you have 422 hours to devote to us, that actually would frighten me if you have that kind of time, and I would like to know what you do for a living. But I think the far more inspiring thing is to just look at that list. Just look at the list of incredible people who are using their voices to make a difference in this world, to raise up the voices of our LGBTQ and ally brothers and sisters. It's just incredible to see them all on one page, and that I've had the opportunity to speak to every single one of them. It just blows my mind. it was so far from our conception when we debuted in 2008. So we are now entering year number 10 of This Show Is So Gay, and we are thrilled to have you along with us. And with that, let's get to the news. The United States Supreme Court has set a December court date for a religious baker who is seeking to undermine LGBT discrimination protections. Jack Phillips of Colorado's Masterpiece Cake Shop is at the center of a case over anti-LGBT discrimination, and that case is going to be heard by the Supreme Court. Phillips launched a legal challenge after being found in violation of state anti-discrimination laws for refusing to serve gay couple David Mullins and Charlie Craig. The baker earlier this year claimed that Jesus would discriminate against gay people. That's what he said, that Jesus would discriminate against gay people, and he continues to insist his religion requires, not endorses, but requires discrimination against gay people. He refused to make a cake for the couple after he found out they were celebrating their wedding. Well, the Supreme Court of the United States is set to weigh in on the case in December, and it could have an extreme effect on LGBTQ rights. A ruling in favor of Jack Phillips, the baker, could have a chilling effect on LGBT rights protections countrywide, and equality activists fear it may end up creating a license for homophobic discrimination based on religion. The case is expected to be close, with President Trump's newly appointed Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch considered a firm vote for the baker's freedom to discriminate. The Trump administration itself has filed a brief backing the freedom to discriminate. President Trump's Justice Department claimed that a ruling against the bakery could create an intrusion against the First Amendment, where a public accommodations law compels someone to create expression for a particular person or entity and to participate, literally or figuratively, in a ceremony or other expressive event. 86 Republican members of Congress have also signed a brief to the U.S. Supreme Court supporting the baker's right to discriminate. The gay couple in the case, David Mullins and Charlie Craig, have vowed to stand up for equality. They said this, quote, "This has always been about more than a cake. Businesses should not be allowed to violate the law and discriminate against us because of who we are and who we love. While we're disappointed that the courts continue debating the simple question of whether LGBT people deserve to be treated like everyone else, we hope that our case helps ensure that no one has to experience being turned away simply because of who they are." The American Civil Liberties Union and the ACLU of Colorado represent Mullins and Craig in the case. Jason Essex, the director of the ACLU's LGBT project, said this, quote, "The law is squarely on David and Charlie's side because when businesses are open to the public, they're supposed to be open to everyone. While the right to one's religious beliefs is fundamental, a license to discriminate is not. Same-sex couples like David and Charlie deserve to be treated with the same dignity and respect as anyone else, and we're ready to take that fight all the way to the Supreme Court," end quote. And that they will be doing, because on December 5th, the Supreme Court will be hearing this really, really important case. It's not just about marriage equality, folks. I mean, you heard that earlier in the show. It is not just about marriage equality. There are so many other issues out there, and this is a big one, a big one. Oh gosh, our thoughts are with everybody in Mississippi, all of our brothers and sisters in Mississippi, because a Mississippi law now makes it legal for religious people to discriminate against gay people. It comes into effect this week. The Republican-dominated state recently passed HB 1523, which is a broad law that grants Mississippians the ability to use so-called religious exemptions to legally deny LGBTQ people employment, housing, adoption rights, marriage license, and even services at a local business. Despite protests from LGBT rights groups, the sweeping law was signed by the state's governor, Phil Bryant, and it comes into effect this week. Sarah Kate Ellis, who is the president and CEO of GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, said this, quote, "America was founded on the freedom of religion, and this shared value continues to be critical to our nation's success, but it does not give people the right to impose their beliefs on others, to harm others, or to discriminate. This law allows hotels, ER doctors, business owners, and even pediatricians to legally deny services to hardworking LGBTQ families in Mississippi, despite the fact that such blatant discrimination flies in the face of Mississippi and American values. The fight is far from over, and we stand with advocates in Mississippi who simply want to be treated equal to their coworkers, friends, and neighbors. The law's passage comes despite research from the Public Religion Research Institute, which shows that a majority of Americans oppose anti-LGBTQ legislation. The polling revealed that more than 6 in 10 Americans oppose allowing small business owners to refuse to provide products or services to gay or lesbian people. Despite being advertised as a religious freedom measure, there is not a single religious group in which a majority supports allowing small business owners to refuse services to gay and lesbian people. 62% of white mainline Protestants oppose the laws, alongside 66% of black Protestants, 52% of Hispanic Protestants, and 62% of Catholics. The research director of that particular study said this, quote, "At a time when Americans appear more divided than ever by partisanship and religion, there is increasing evidence that debates over gay rights have a short shelf life." But apparently not so in Mississippi. A further statement from the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation said this, quote, "Since the HB 1523 debate began, GLAAD has been on the ground in Mississippi working with local organizations like the Mississippi Gulf Coast Rainbow Center, the Spectrum Center, and Joshua Generation MCC to help accelerate acceptance for LGBTQ people in the state and protect them from discrimination. From launching a hashtag MyMississippi campaign, a campaign geared to amplify voices of LGBTQ Mississippi, releasing a media resource guide on LGBTQ people living in the state, to co-hosting a United Against Hate rally against HB 1523 last December, GLAAD has been with LGBTQ Mississippians to fight back against this discriminatory religious exemptions agenda and will continue to complement and amplify their efforts." Wow. So that is in Mississippi, where a law they passed that severely, severely restricts the rights of LGBTQ people in that state goes into effect this week. I know I just said it a few minutes ago, but I will say it again. So much more work to do. President Donald Trump is packing American courts. I mean, this is further not good news for us. President Donald Trump is packing American courts with anti-LGBT and anti-abortion judges, and he's choosing more than any of his three predecessors. 10 months into his presidency, Donald Trump has nominated more Senate judges than President Barack Obama, President George W. Bush, or President Bill Clinton. And looking at the views held by these judges, it seems as though there will be far more conservative group of people now helping to shape U.S. laws. Carl Tobia, a University of Richmond law professor who specializes in judicial nominations, told the Huffington Post this, quote, "Trump's speed in nominating judges has been perhaps the most successful aspect of his presidency. Trump has easily surpassed Obama, Bush, and Clinton at this point in the first year of their presidencies in terms of the sheer number nominated." He also has more seats to fill due to inheriting 108 court vacancies after winning the presidential race. And a lot of these nominees are looking to be severely, severely anti-gay and very much restrict abortion rights. And I'm sure that we will see the effects of those in years to come. 17-year-old Styles Zuschlag has defied transphobia by being crowned homecoming king at his new school. That seems like really good news, and it is really good news because Styles was forced out of his previous high school for being transgender and going against the school's religious beliefs, and that sparked his move to Noble High School in Maine. Styles said he had a very high grade point average and was looking to become valedictorian of his previous Christian school, but when he went to speak to a school administrator about being recognized as male, he was instead given an ultimatum. The school ordered him to, quote, confess his sins, stop taking testosterone treatments, and receive Christian counseling. And if he refused, then he was expected to find a new school. So Styles left Tri-City and enrolled at Noble High School, where despite being terrified, he made new friends along with the few that he already had there. And just 1 month after joining the public school, he was awarded the title of Homecoming King. I love that. He said this, quote, "It's something I never thought could have happened to me." That is a heartwarming story. So our congratulations to 17-year-old Styles Zuschlag, who left his previous school, went to a new school, and became the homecoming king. Love it. Absolutely love it. A gay coffee shop owner has taken a stand against anti-abortion campaigners whose leaflets feature rainbow hands dripping with the blood of a dead fetus. What a horrible advertisement, and I warn you to not even look at the advertisement online, but we still want to tell you the story. The activists were ejected from Bedlam Coffee in Seattle, Washington, after the gay owner was made aware of the horrific flyer. On the page, the rainbow hands hover above the fetus, seemingly having just dropped it, below the words, "This is the truly oppressed person in our idolatrous culture of death." Oh, it is terrible. It is terrible. I just saw it again, and I didn't mean to. The gruesome leaflet, and it is truly gruesome, directly links all LGBT people with what these anti-abortion extremists view as comparable to the Holocaust. On the page, scrawled across the pride flag, are the words hatred, bigotry, intolerance, and oppression. Approaching the campaigners, who call themselves abolitionists, thus comparing their cause to slavery, owner of this coffee shop, Ben Borgman, said, quote, "I'm gay, you have to leave. This is offensive to me. I own the place. I have the right to be offended." And so he thus kicked them out. That's just one gentleman taking a stand, using his voice in the way that he knows how to use it to create the space that he wants to create.
Well, the White House has been pretty darn busy with anti-LGBTQ stuff. And here's another chapter in that. The White House has revoked support for a rainbow flag ceremony at the historic Stonewall Inn. The National Park Service had been set to make a historic appearance at the Stonewall National Monument in order to raise the rainbow flag. President Obama, if you all will recall, this was big news last summer, President Obama dedicated the Stonewall National Monument in June of 2016. The event had been scheduled for noon of Wednesday of this week and would have been the first time the rainbow flag would have flown over federally funded land. It would have also been the first time that the National Park Service had been responsible for the care of such a symbol as the rainbow flag. Wouldn't it be great if the next sentence of the story was, "And then it all came to pass. And then it happened." But no, that's not what happened. The Trump administration pulled the flag as the National Park Service withdrew from the event at the last minute. It also gave up responsibility for maintaining the flagpole and its flag. Instead, it will now be managed by the City of New York. As well as abdicating their responsibility for the flag, the National Park Service also removed the map of the Stonewall National Monument from its website. That is correct. The National Park Service also removed the map of the Stonewall National Monument from their website. Staff from the National Park Service would have attended, but Barbara Applebaum, the Chief of Interpretation, Education, and Visitor Services, pulled out of speaking, saying she had a, quote, scheduling conflict. The Interior Department was ordered by President Trump in April to review all landmark designations made in the past 20 years to discern whether they are within the law's intent. According to the National Park Service, which defended its decision to pull out, the confusion comes down to a jurisdiction issue. A spokesperson said this, quote, "The flagpole is not on federal property. It's a separate monument to the first person killed in the Civil War. It has never been a part of the Stonewall National Monument, although it is located there. The flagpole is not managed by the Park Service. We gifted the flag to New York City Parks." But the move has been seen by many, including me, as part of a wider distance growing between the White House and anything LGBTQ related. Anything at all. The news comes as President Trump is to address a conference of a recognized anti-LGBT hate group. That's right. President Trump is to address the conference of a recognized LGBT hate group. He will speak at the Values Voters Summit in Washington, D.C. at the end of this week. He will become the first United States president to address this gathering run by an organization who has been classified as a hate group. The event hosts a coalition of white supremacists, far-right activists, and religious extremists among its attendees. When he was a presidential candidate in 2016, President Trump, then candidate Trump, spoke at the event. It is run by the Family Research Council. That's right, the Family Research Council. But no former president has ever appeared at this event while in office. Among the other speakers is former Duck Dynasty star Phil Robertson, who has said he wants to rid the earth of wicked gays, Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, you know, Roy Moore, the guy who used to be the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court but was removed twice, but is still the GOP-nominated candidate to replace Attorney General Sessions there in the great state of Alabama. Roy Moore will also be addressing the event. Roy Moore, who said he doesn't know whether or not gays and lesbians should be put to death. He's just not sure. Roy Moore, of course, is now backed by Donald Trump. And again, he was twice removed as the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court due to his ignoring the U.S. Supreme Court ruling in favor of marriage equality. He also has ties, Roy Moore, to an extremist pastor who has called for gay people to be put to death. So these are the people who are going to be hanging out at this summit that Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, will be speaking at, the first U.S. president who will be speaking there. Another LGBT rights opponent Trump will be speaking alongside is Steve Scalise, the House Majority Whip. A few months ago, Republican Congressman Steve Scalise had his life saved by a heroic lesbian police officer, and now fully recovered from the attack, one of his first actions on his return to his job will be to give a speech at the Family Research Council. The Southern Poverty Law Center lists the Family Research Council as an extremist group with an anti-LGBT ideology. On their own website, it says this, quote, Family Research Council believes that homosexual conduct is harmful. This is from the Family Research Council's website, not from the Southern Poverty Law Center's website. This is from their own website. Quote, Family Research Council believes that homosexual conduct is harmful to the persons who engage in it and to society at large and can never be affirmed. It is by definition unnatural and as such is associated with negative physical and psychological health effects. Tony Perkins, the Family Research Council's president, said that Representative Scalise's return to health was not down to the brave actions of a lesbian police officer, but instead, quote, as an answer to prayer. Tony Perkins said this, quote, his fighting spirit in overcoming the odds is a source of inspiration for those who are fighting for the heart and soul of our nation and our culture. I look forward to welcoming my friend and former colleague back to the Values Voter stage. Tony Perkins, his own history of anti-LGBTQ views, he once speculated that flooding was God's punishment for homosexuals. However, when his own home was destroyed in what he called a flood of near-biblical proportions, the homophobic pastor insisted it happened because of God's love. The Values Voter Summit. President Donald Trump, the first U.S. president, the first sitting president to appear at this intensely homophobic group of people. And no doubt what's going to happen, there are going to be intensely homophobic things said at the Values Voter Summit. I don't know how Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, will distance himself from that, but it absolutely is going to happen. We need to take a break. We're going to come back to the Trump administration for a second, but there is other news out there. The Boy Scouts of America, huge, huge news here. The Boy Scouts of America, they have announced they will now allow girls to join their ranks for the first time. The Boy Scouts of America earlier this year announced that they were changing their policy to allow trans boys to enroll in their programs. The Boy Scouts of America then told everybody in the world that they have made the decision to change their policy to mean that the gender listed on an application to become a scout is the basis for their enrollment process. Previously, the Boy Scouts of America had checked the birth certificate of each applicant, but then they made the change earlier this year to say, you know what, it's about the gender you identify with on your application, not on your birth certificate. Really great news for the Boy Scouts of America, and it continues. This week, the Boy Scouts of America announced their plans to allow girls to join their ranks and to progress up to the rank of Eagle Scout. Michael Serbach, the chief executive of the Boy Scouts, said this, quote, "We believe it is critical to evolve how our programs meet the needs of families interested in positive and lifelong experiences for their children." The Boy Scouts of America's Board of Directors voted unanimously to make the change to their policy. This is a 100-year-old organization that is now, for the first time, allowing girls to join their ranks. The change will take effect next year. They said in a statement, quote, "Cub Scout dens will be single gender, all boys or all girls." The National Organization for Women had urged the Boy Scouts of America to change their policy. Sydney Ireland had spoken on behalf of the National Organization of Women to say that she hoped to become an Eagle Scout like her older brother had. She said this, quote, "I just want to do what the Boy Scouts do, earn the merit badges and earn the Eagle Award. The Girl Scouts is a great organization, but it's just not the program that I want to be part of. I think girls should have the opportunity to be a member of any organization they want, regardless of gender." The National Organization of Women issued a statement in January saying they were inspired by a 15-year-old New York City girl's wishes to join the Boy Scouts of America to follow in her brother's footsteps. The president of the National Organization of Women, Terry O'Neill, said this, quote, "Women can now hold all combat roles in the military, and women have broken many glass ceilings at the top levels of government, business, academia, and entertainment. It's long past due that girls have equal opportunities in scouting." This is really exciting stuff. We love when these organizations evolve with the times. Certainly, the Boy Scouts of America has quite a checkered past when it comes to inclusivity and to equality, but this would be a big step forward. So kudos to the Boy Scouts of America. And come on, guys and girls, let's get everybody to be members of the Boy Scouts of America. Very exciting stuff. Well, my friends, it is another week here on This Show Is So Gay, and thus another week where we have to talk about the ban on trans people in the military. Last year, every single week, it was, hey, what's going on in North Carolina with the bathroom bills? This year, yet another update and two updates for you on the ban on trans people serving in the military. Congress has now demanded that President Trump provide proof for his claims that generals support his contentious ban on trans people in the military. Just to remind you, in case somehow you are crawling out from a hole and hearing this for the first time, President Trump abruptly announced on Twitter earlier this year that trans people would be banned from serving in the military. He wrote this, quote, "After consultation with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory and cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgender in the military would entail." So, despite his claims that the decision was taken, quote, "after consultation with my generals, insider sources maintain that the Pentagon was not consulted and that Trump made the decision to appease anti-LGBT Republicans who had been moving on the issue in Congress." As President Trump's Defense Secretary, James Mad Dog Mattis, pushes ahead with the administration's plans to ban transgender people from the military, Democrats this week demand that President Trump substantiate his claim. 114 members of Congress this week signed a letter requesting that the White House release any correspondence with the Pentagon and military officials that took place prior to the announcement. This letter says this, quote, "We request information about what discussions or correspondence between the White House and the Pentagon, if any, led President Trump to make his assertion. If senior military or Department of Defense personnel asked that the president ban transgender individuals from military service, we request access to any letters, emails, telephone transcripts, meeting logs and minutes, or other materials that document such requests. If the department has records of any other discussions that might have justified the president's claim, we request to see those materials as well. We seek access to these materials in order to determine whether the president, his national security team, and military leaders are actively coordinating policy with one another, or whether the president's transgender ban announcement reflected a breakdown in communication. As you know, clear communication between the White House and the Pentagon is essential to our nation's security. We thank you for your consideration, and we look forward to receiving your reply." Now, of course, all 114 of these signatures on this letter are Democrats. Not a single Republican lawmaker has signed the letter asking to see evidence, but that is not to say that there isn't Republican opposition to this ban on trans people serving in the military. Most famously, John McCain, Senator McCain, has raised his voice to say, as long as someone is fit to serve, they should be able to serve. But that is not the only story this week on the trans ban. According to the Trump administration, one of the lawsuits to block the reinstatement of the transgender military ban is, quote, premature and should be dismissed because trans service members have not yet suffered harm from the policy. Huh. The Department of Justice made that argument in a brief filed in the case of Doe versus Trump, the first of four lawsuits filed to challenge this ban. The National Center for Lesbian Rights and the GLBTQ advocates and defenders filed the suit in August on behalf of several trans people either serving in the military or planning to join, and sought a preliminary injunction to keep the policy from going into effect while the suit makes its way through the courts. The Justice Department said the motion for a preliminary injunction should be dismissed, and its motion to dismiss the case altogether should be granted. The legal challenge to the ban is, quote, premature several times over, the department said in their brief. It was filed this week in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. The brief reads this, quote, the president's memorandum states that no policy changes to the status quo will be effective until at least January 2018. The president further directed the Secretary of Defense to determine how to address transgender individuals currently serving in the military and that no action be taken against such individuals until after a policy review is completed. So this is despite the fact that President Trump tweeted out, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. And despite the fact that all of his spokespeople continuously remind us over and over again that his tweets represent policy. Of course, Kellyanne Conway has said repeatedly, no, this wasn't policy. This was the promise of a policy. Except that President Trump officially said on Twitter, please be advised, the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the military. Well, the attorneys for the National Center for Lesbian Rights and the GLBTQ advocates and defenders, they denounced the Justice Department's argument. They said this, quote, the government's response reads like pure fiction. It states a fantasy that the president's announcement of a ban on military service for transgender people has changed nothing. That's simply not true. Every day this reckless ban stays in place, our military strength is diminished and our country is less safe for it. We are optimistic the court will see through this smokescreen and halt the ban. The president's attack on transgender service members who have dedicated their lives to serving our country is unconscionable. Rather than even attempting to defend it, the Department of Justice is asking the court to turn a blind eye to the devastation the president has caused in the lives of real people and real families. Because of the president's ban, smart, dedicated, and idealistic young people like our plaintiffs, Reagan Kibbe and Dylan Cohere, are barred from fulfilling their dreams of military service, and transgender people who are already serving have been told that their skills, training, and years of dedicated service are not valued. The ban has left them scrambling to make new plans for their futures, just as it has undermined our nation's security. This is the exact opposite of how military policy should be made. More and more every week, we will probably have a different update for you on what is going on with President Trump's tweets banning trans people from serving in the military, banning trans people from even trying to serve in the military. Let's turn our attention to the great state of Utah. After a year-long legal battle, Equality Utah and three student plaintiffs have taken down the Beehive State's law that prohibited students and teachers from discussing homosexuality in schools. This is a big victory. Katie Smith Gish, Josh Greer, and Caden Turkle took their case against the State Board of Education and reached a settlement this week with the State Board and the Attorney General's Office, according to Equality Utah. In response to the law, lawsuit, the Utah legislature this spring repealed the state's No Promo Homo law with SB 196, which passed with a nearly unanimous vote. Now, the Utah State Board of Education has issued a letter to schools to clarify the intent of SB 196, expressing the board's desire to ensure that each student in Utah public schools receives a high-quality education free from all manner of discrimination, which can take the form of bullying based on religion, race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, and gender identity. The lawsuit had made Utah one of only two states that have ever repealed a law against so-called promotion of homosexuality. The other state is California. Equality Utah's attorneys, a legal team at the nonprofit National Center for Lesbian Rights, and the law firm of Ropes and Gray filed a motion with the court requesting that the case be closed. The groups worked pro bono for the case. This is a big victory. This means that so many of the conversations that need to be taking place in schools will actually happen, and there won't be a ban on that. So, a huge move forward for the great state of Utah. More national news. Dozens of companies, including Alphabet Inc.'s Google, Apple, Microsoft Corporation, and Viacom, have asked the United States Supreme Court to address whether a law banning sex discrimination in the workplace provides protections to gay employees. A group of 76 companies submitted a brief to the court saying a split among lower courts on that question had created uncertainty for employers and gay workers. The companies asked the Supreme Court to take up the case of Jamaica Evans, a former security guard at a Georgia hospital who says she was harassed and forced to quit her job because she is a lesbian. The company said the lack of a federal law clearly prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation has hindered recruitment in the 27 states that have not adopted their own such laws. And, according to lawyers at Quinn Emanuel, Urquhart & Sullivan, quote, the uncertainty and vulnerability LGBT workers face result in diminished employee health, productivity, job engagement, and satisfaction. A federal appeals court in Atlanta this past March dismissed the case, saying her claims were foreclosed by prior decisions that said that discrimination against gay employees is not a form of unlawful sex discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The Supreme Court will likely decide by the end of the year whether or not they will take this case. Because in another case, a different appeals court in Chicago became the first to rule in favor of a gay worker under Title VII. That happened back in April. And then in June, about 50 of the same companies involved in this week's brief asked an appeals court in Manhattan to do the same. So there is so much uncertainty out there around employment protection, right? I live in Ohio. Here in Ohio, there are absolutely no protections for employment on the basis of sexual orientation. There are no protections for public accommodations or for housing. I am in one of those states, a huge adjustment for me to come from the great state of Vermont, where, you know, it's kind of like gay Mecca there in Vermont. And now I'm here in the state of Ohio, where do I think that my employer is going to fire me for being gay? No, I don't think that's actually going to happen. But the fact that it could, that's pretty messed up. Pretty messed up. So, as if I haven't said it 14 times already this episode, so much more work to do. And look at all the great people out there doing it. Our huge thanks to Brian Silva, who is doing such great work with NEAT. That would be the National Equality Action Team. You can learn more about them by going to theneat.org. That's theneat.org. And as always, I implore you guys to get out there and use your voice the way you know how to use it. I've been hosting this show for 10 years. This is what I know how to do. And I wrote a book, and you guys should go to Amazon and you should pick it up because that would be awesome. It's super on sale right now and you can get it pretty darn cheap. It's called Seriously, What Am I Doing Here? The Adventures of a Wondering and Wandering Gay Jew. Go pick it up and, you know, figure out what it is that you need to do to use your voice to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of our allies out there. Put on your cape, get out there, make a difference. And while you're out there, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?